Hello, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Firm Discussions, a new show, a part of the Punch Card Investing podcast. So today I'm joined by Spencer Garnett of Brealey Capital, and we're going to be talking about a company that both of us have written about, and I think both of us own, called TinyBuild. But before we get onto that, Spencer, could you give us a little bit of info about yourself and what you're doing with your newsletter?
Sure. So I'm a college student. I'm going into my last year of school, and I'm hoping to go into the world of finance in an official capacity, at least. So I started Brealey Capital, the newsletter, kind of as a tool for networking and as a resume for myself.
Excellent. And I guess it's probably the audience have probably guessed that you're into sort of the more value side of things, but how would you sort of describe your approach to investing?
I should probably start by going with, I don't look at macro. I don't use technicals, any of that stuff. I'm very bottoms up. But then from there, I don't really do growth or value. I don't believe in growth or value because I think it's largely to an extent, often one and the same. So I kind of split investing into three buckets. I use secular, cyclical, and special situations. So secular is a company I can own and will grow for a long time. So that could be low growth, but that's the company that's directionally going up and to the right, hopefully. Then cyclicals are going to be, I mean, that's easier, right? Companies that don't really grow too much, but they up and down and cycle and think commodities. Then special situations are special situations usually caused by corporate actions. And often I'll like to marry that in with something else. But my typical favorite situation would be, A, just find a long-term or secular opportunity. And then maybe marry that with a special situation to get a little extra upside at the beginning.
Yeah, and that sort of special situation can often provide, like you say, a little bit of upside at the beginning. And it can sometimes, it can be an extra catalyst to help you close that gap if there is a discount there. Right, so maybe we can just get straight into it then.
Sure.
So for people that haven't heard about the company before, maybe you can just give us a quick overview of what TinyBuild does.
Sure. So this is another answer that right away might be a little different from how you'd expect me to answer this. I'd say TinyBuild is a media and content creation company that primarily focuses on developing and publishing video games. And I say that for two reasons. The first being that's kind of how the company looks at it themselves. Besides the video game publishing, you know, developing and publishing, they have products around the IP they create. So toys, they're working on animated series and et cetera, comic books. And the other would be, which goes hand in hand, is they're not competing with just other video game developers and publishers. They're competing for your time. So they're competing with Netflix. They're competing with live television. This is eyeballs and time in the day rather than just video games.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary. I mean, I might add a little bit that they sort of had their roots in the sort of third party publishing realm. That's sort of they kind of started out. They've actually been around for, even though they IPO'd in 2021, they've actually been around for around about, I think they were incorporated in 2013. I think that's right. So yeah, they've been around for quite a while, and they started off publishing their own game, which I think was called No Time to Explain. And then they progressed from there to doing the same thing, helping to publish some third-party titles, and then moved from there to the first kind of own IP title being the Hello Neighbor games, which I think is what you were mentioning when you were saying about the comic book series and all the other stuff around it. That was probably the first example of them really doing that and scaling up that a franchise. So maybe you can go a little bit into the company's business model, and I think we touched on a little bit there, but maybe go into it and talk about what sets it apart from its competition. As in, when I say competition, I mean the other sort of indie publishers out there.
Sure. So I should probably preface this one as well with, I don't believe the industry has any moats other than simply having great IP. Whether it's like game engines like Epic's Unreal, or just outsourcing to someone like Keywords, or going through the AppLovin platform, is the barriers to entry are very slim. So outside of having great IP, I don't believe there really is much barrier to entry, if any. So that said, I do think there's a lot of things that... So I recently did a write-up on the company, and there was a section that I called What They Do Right. So I'll run through that list, and if you want to touch on any of them in particular, we can get into it.
Sounds good.
So vertical integration, high percentage of own IP, focus on franchises, high percentage of sales from back catalog, an emphasis on gaming as a service and monetizable events, ubiquitous distribution, engaged development, use of multimedia and creative advertising, a portfolio-first approach, a test-first framework, the acqui-hire method, a decentralized structure, and then the softer, for lack of a better term, things they do right, would be they take a long-term mentality, they're very open-minded, and they emphasize a culture that puts an emphasis on people.
Yeah, no, I think you've covered most of the bases there. Yeah, perhaps the only thing I'd mention as well is something that has been a source of quite a lot of their IP. I think they've had something like 30 or maybe even 50 games come out of it, is the DevGam conference series, which they do as well. They own they have a 51% stake in a gaming development conference and events company, which I think was originally founded in Ukraine. That was there where their first conference was held. And it's actually run by CEO Alex Nishiporchik's wife, who was the founder of this gaming events company. And yeah, it's been a source of a lot of the game IP. I didn't realize quite a few of them, but things like games like Graveyard Keeper, I believe, was one example, which has been one of their biggest hit games. I think the game still has something like, it has daily peaks just on Steam rankings of like 2,500 concurrent users or something like that, which is kind of like what a lot of indie games hope to get as their peak at launch, and it still has that 5 years down the line on average day of the week. So yeah, they've got some it's given a way of them raising the company's profile, and it is a way of them. Yes, IP is I agree, the only thing that really sets people apart, which is why it's important when you get a successful IP to build up these franchises as they're doing. But also, these conferences have been a real way for them to get access to some of the talent, especially from sort of Eastern Europe, which is where a lot of the conferences are held. They're holding one in Lisbon, Portugal, this year, and I think they'll be holding one in London at some point as well. But they originally started off right in that Eastern European bloc with Lithuania, Ukraine, what have you. And access to those developers Eastern Europe is a real amazing source for development talent. You just have to look at like things like The Witcher, for instance, was developed by CD Projekt in Poland. Another Polish studio being 11-bit that did Frostpunk and This War of Mine, two like really big hit indie games. Yeah, so there's just a lot of talent coming out of that part of the world, and having a company that has people that speak that language and has the connection and the actual development stuff in there is a real edge over some of the larger, more Western competitors based in the UK or in Northern Western Europe and in the US and so on. So yeah, it's definitely a real asset there for the company.
Yeah, I think a really good mental model to kind of think about the company to an extent is kind of as a platform where they have to manage two sides of this. So what most people think about when they're thinking about gaming or media companies is the consumer side of that. Well, those, right, you're thinking about the games, the content, all that stuff. But what you also have to think about is the fact that someone needs to create that content. And so besides managing the output on the consumer end, Tiny Build also a lot through things like DevGam is exceptional at managing the pipeline of developers that they bring into, again, think about it almost as a platform to develop the games and put out that consumer output.
Hmm. And maybe you want to, do you want to touch a little bit on the acquire hire model as well as part of that, and how that, how they've used that to sort of get to bring IP from third party to first party?
Yeah, sure. So that, I also want to add in that that this ties hand in hand very well with the decentralized structure. So we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. So what they'll do is, or maybe let's start with what other companies do, is other companies will buy a set of IP, take it over, and then that's that. Tiny Build is very good at, when they take in an IP, they will also acquire through acquisition, hire the development team of the creator of the IP. And also, and then add in the decentralized structure. And so they're kind of acting as they were before within the Tiny Build ecosystem. So they take on this ownership mentality where now you have the original vision, the original direction of the intellectual property being guided by its original owners, which I think is important in putting out that successful content.
Absolutely, yeah. And it helps them to, yeah, if they're wanting to, so acquiring the IP allows them to branch out into maybe other game concepts within the same franchise. Like, for instance, when they acquired the Hello Neighbor IP, they got the original development team to sort of continue work on a similar game within the series that would be Hello Neighbor 2. And then they, at the same time, started development on a search and rescue game, which a VR title. They had Secret Neighbor, which was like an online multiplayer game. They had Hello Engineer, which is like a completely different concept entirely. And all these games are then allowed to be developed by alternative studios, so they can leverage the reach and the resources of the overall company. But they still had the original development team there to work on the next edition in the series from the actual game, the sequel, the direct sequel to it.
Yep, that's right. They have the, by getting the, by using the acquihire to bring in that team, they keep in that vision around the original IP and the direction they want to go with.
Yeah, and I mean, it's something they've done, just to give you listeners an idea of how much of this they've done. They've managed to do it for an awful lot of their IP. I think it's now something like 80% last year or something of the royalties coming into the company were from own IP titles. So that means it's either they own the IP and directly the developers are internal to the company, so they call that first party, or it's second party where they own the company owns the IP, but they have the developers brought on as contractors, so they're not actually counted as employees of the company. And I think a lot of the acquire hires have largely been this sort of second party model there, because I think the development team often retains its autonomy and is still an external entity to the company. And then the company, for things like when they were doing Secret Neighbor, for instance, the multiplayer game, that was developed largely by Hologriff, I believe, one of their internal studios. So that would be then a first party title, just to give you a bit of a sort of separation there.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about this again would be Alex describes as the CEO in the annual report, where you'll have the either contractor or in-house studio in the middle. And then on top, they say they have the corporate structure to keep the, as an umbrella to keep the rain out, and on the bottom, a support system. So it really is about using this acqui-hire and decentralized structure, and then from there, supporting them with the resources they need to put out that great content.
Absolutely, yeah. And maybe, yeah, we should touch on that a little bit, because that sort of touches on the vertical integration component. Something that they've been doing since they IPO'd is trying to expand out their capacity, because a lot of, and this is another thing that's a potential advantage for them versus some of their peers, is that a lot of their peers rely on external studios for things like porting or for quality assurance. And so Tinybud has been trying to mitigate some of these things and prevent delays in releases because of reliance on external parties. So they've been sort of trying to build in and vertically integrate all those things. So maybe you could talk about some of the steps they've taken there, like what have they added to the studio and to the company, and what's gone well and what's not gone so well.
I mean, the top of my head, let's go with what hasn't gone well, has been the Red Cerebrus acquisition, which they were, the positive of that was, I forget what the exact piece was, but they wanted something from that for and the Versus Evil for, I'm blanking on what it is, but for a vertical integration aspect. But the content, the IP, has not done particularly great. Definitely not what they expected. They've, to my knowledge, they've pretty much in-house just about everything at this point. I mean, obviously, they're not running consoles. They're not running platforms. They still need to do things like have the deals with Microsoft and Sony, and they're in the bundle with Microsoft. But other than that, to my knowledge, they have the whole entire vertical integration process from start to finish.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, they've successfully brought in porting studios to help them on release, allow them to either port games that they've previously released on PC to consoles, or to allow them to have the capacity to simultaneously release some of their bigger titles across, which they within existing franchises that they're pretty confident will be successful on multiple platforms across the different platforms simultaneously. So they've got that capacity. And what you're referring to with the Versus Evil and Red Cerberus, so they acquired Versus Evil, and which is a US publisher, another indie publisher that is entirely third party. And they had a subsidiary called Red Cerberus, which I believe is based in Brazil, somewhere in South America anyway. And they had quite a big workforce. So it was a bit of it pretty much doubled the overall company's workforce, because I think Red Cerberus on its own had about 200 employees, because it was, like I say, largely the quality assurance side of things. So they were at the time pretty much largely working on external contract work for other companies. I don't think Versus Evil had enough games in their pipeline to justify having the 200 people just developing those, because I think overall Versus Evil had something like 50 employees. But yeah, they're quite a big third-party indie publisher. But yeah, I think the idea when they did the acquisition was to try and bring to change their culture and bring them over to the own IP model. So switching to sort of try and bring in some of these games and develop them internally, or still use external developers but own the IP for them. So acquiring the IP or sourcing it internally. And they thus far, it seems, since the acquisition, haven't been able to do that because we haven't got any own IP titles, first party or second party IP titles have been released. It's all still third party. So I think that's largely where the failure has been there. And I did actually ask a question about this at the AGM, which I attended in London, 29th of June, so just over a month ago. And I asked what would be, if you could, what were the sort of key lessons, the takeaways from the Versus Eagle acquisition, and what would you say, what would you do differently if you were to do another one in the future? And the response I got back was quite interesting. It was saying that it was Versus Evil and Red Cerberus subsidiary acquisition was the only deal they've done thus far where they didn't actually have an initial working relationship with the developers. And I think this speaks to the power of the acquire-hire model, because they're often games that they initially published. So they've already had that experience of working with the developers. They know that they're a compatible match, and then they buy effectively in-house the IP and the development team. And they didn't have that kind of relationship. They'd never worked with Versus Evil before, and so they didn't know, they hadn't sort of de-risked the deal at that point. So I think that was the key lesson they took away. But one positive of this, the way they structured the deal was, they had quite a bit of the payment was in contingent consideration, so it wasn't actually paid up front, which meant that they were able to, they just held it as, recognize it as goodwill asset initially on the balance sheet, and then a contingent consideration liability matching it. And so when they realized, okay, the goodwill, which at this point had been attributed to what they thought they could have got out of the company if they'd been able to bring in the, you know, if they had been able to transition them to the same kind of own IP, first and second party IP model as Tiny Build, they would have been able to get increase the margins, and then that would have justified, they'd have been able to earn out that extra contingent consideration. But because that was not looking like it was going to happen, it wasn't performing as well as hoped, they were able to effectively wipe out that goodwill without actually any cash having changed hands, without any shares having changed hands. So there could be further write-downs from there, but it might not be entirely protected, but certainly a big chunk of the overall consideration that potentially could have been paid by the shareholders of Tiny Build, they were shielded from that. So yeah, there was a good mark in their favor in terms of how they actually de-risked the transaction, even though they now admit that it was probably a mistake. Yeah, I think the overall goal of that with the Versus Evil was to expand their publishing capacity and help them to grow out, and therefore, you know, just the sort of revenue base that they can generate, that widen the overall portfolio and everything, which is their mission of diversification. And then obviously Red Cerberus as well, the subsidiary, was to allow them to have that quality assurance in place internally, so they don't have to rely on external studios and so on. So those things are still in place. I just don't think they're performing as well as they'd hoped.
I would say that's correct. But I think you touched on the key positive there, which was definitely something that hampered them in the early days, of they've gotten much better and much more sophisticated at learning how to structure deals. Mm. And I think that's definitely become a big net positive, because initially that was a problem point for them.
And it also protected them, actually, when, as we'll touch on later, the stock price fell. It could have been quite negative when they were paying contingent consideration on some of these acquisitions they did, which quite a bit of them have been structured to pay out shares. If the share price had fallen, then we could end up with some massive level of dilution of the existing shareholders. And so that was quite a big concern when I originally was looking into the company, but thankfully they completely cleared those fears out by saying that all of their contracts come with a clause that says if the share price falls by a certain percentage, they have the option to pay the consideration in cash, which they have elected to do on all situations where that applies. So to prevent that excess dilution of the existing shareholder base. So yeah, another mark in favor of the way they've been structuring these sort of acquisition contracts. Yeah, so maybe we can move on now a little bit. We've mentioned management in a couple of places here, but maybe you could sort of lay out for us who the management of the company is and how you'd sort of rate them, how they've been doing since they went public.
Sure. So, I mean, we'll start with founder, CEO, and about 38% shareholder, who is Alex Nichiporchik. I hope I didn't butcher that too much. And simply put, I think he is spectacular. He's done some great podcasts, including with you, on his background. And I think that's definitely worth, I'll touch on it briefly, but worth really listening to him talk about, where he essentially dropped out of school. He became a pro gamer and has since touched every single part of the industry from pro gamer to journalist to, I believe he was a marketing executive and then starting up his own company. And I think, again, he's all around spectacular. He's this rare combination of nose to the ground hustler, but great strategic thinker. And he has very good people skills as well, by all accounts. And so I think this combination is pretty rare and makes him a very good leader of the company. More than qualified.
Yeah, I think you said it very well there. So who else should be mentioned, do you think? So we've had a few management changes, particularly this year. So maybe you could sort of touch on them a little bit. So we originally had,
Sure.
Maybe tell us who's changed and who's in place
I'm
now.
A believer in you praise by name and criticize by category. So I won't get into who's left, but just to kind of touch on Jazz, the new CFO. By all accounts, he's spectacular as well. He has a pretty standard, but a more than qualified background through investment banking and a couple other things. I've had some brief interactions with him, and he is highly engaged and Dan seems to really know what he's doing.
Yeah, I think he's definitely a good fit for the role, and interactions I've had as well have been positive. Yeah, and what's potentially quite positive as well is because his background is more on the sort of equity research and so on side of things. Because previously he was the sort of head of investor relations / head of merger and acquisition for the company. And so he's transitioned from that role to assuming the CFO role. And what's potentially quite positive is that something that really the company now needs is probably a good relationship with investors to help promote it. And so, just help to inform investors about what's, to help them to understand the company and to allow for transparency and what have you, and just give them the information they need. And I think having somebody who's been on the equity research side of things as well is going to be someone that's going to help to have that good line of communication with investors. So yeah, I think it could work out to be a positive overall. So
I agree.
Yeah. So just the other thing to note, we also had the COO depart, who was originally, I think, wasn't one of the founders, but he'd been an early member of the company, and he had something like a 7% stake, which I believe he still holds, because it would have had to have been disclosed if he had sold that position, I believe. So but he left largely for family reasons. I believe he'd been on a paternity leave for a period of time before he left. So I think, yeah, Alex is still around and I think very dedicated. And it would be worth mentioning as well when we're talking about employees and how the company treats its employees and so on. Maybe we should touch a little bit on a couple of things. One would be that the employee turnover is low single digits compared to sort of like an industry average. The gaming industry is notorious for having high turnover, and I think the average is something like 15%. And this is because of the culture of crunching and what have you. It's particularly in some of the bigger studios. So that's a real mark in favor of the company, and it's something that will attract the talent to the company. That sort of good positive culture and help to retain them. And the other thing we should probably mention is maybe you want to go through this is what happened with the workforce that was in Russia and Ukraine at the time of the conflict.
Sure. So I'd say the best source for this would be Alex himself. There is a podcast in which he goes through this. But relatively briefly, is a large amount of the employee base was based out of Russia and Ukraine. And Alex, I think he said starting in like November, December, he was already starting to get concerned. And they planned and moved everybody who wanted to get out, they planned to getting them out, got them out to Serbia and a couple other countries. I mean, the amount of planning that went into this was incredible, and how well thought through the whole thing was incredible. So we got all those, a significant amount of the employees in Russia and Ukraine out. I believe everybody in Russia was gotten out of the country. A few employees by choice decided to stay in Ukraine. I think this part is particularly incredible, where they actually wanted to keep working, because in this case it was it's awful situation.
I don't think a lot of the men had a choice. I think there was a rule against them, a law against them leaving. So there was that component.
Alex was far enough ahead that, yeah, I could be wrong, but I'm like 95% sure here. It's probably lower than that. But I'm pretty sure that he was far enough ahead of it that he was able to get most of them out before the war had even started. So the employees that were in Ukraine that wanted to get out before the war started were able to get out. I believe he was early enough ahead on that. I think he said he was maybe a week or two ahead. Again, I could be wrong there, but I'm pretty sure. But the coding and game development was a getaway for them. So these employees would code with only 5 hours of energy a day on a generator. And between that, they're in a war-torn country putting out games. It's really incredible.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. They managed to, the game still managed to release on schedule, even under those circumstances. But yeah, I think, as I understand it, they were in the process, they'd actually purchased another office in Lviv, one of the westernmost cities of Ukraine. And they still had the lease on the previous office when the war broke out. So they basically, instead of cancelling the lease, as they were planning to do, kept it on and extended it, and it allowed them to have space to house employees initially, and then also to continue sort of, and their families and so on, and to continue to work. And they're able to get out a lot of people. But yeah, as you say, some people were either forced to stay or chose to stay. And they tried to provide them a safe environment, but yeah, still developing under conditions where you have like, I think the generators allowed them to extend the hours a little bit further. But yeah, I think just the grid only had 5 hours of of power a day, something crazy like that. So yeah, and they were using sort of Starlink satellites and stuff like that to do their connections, remote connections and so on. So yeah, quite
incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And there was anyone I don't know if how this works, if you could like link that interview, because I don't believe he touched on that in the one that you did with him. You actually, it was the one you directed me to. And I mean, that one is an incredible listen. Just hearing him talk about planning that out, it is unreal.
I think it was a podcast run by Dice, the game. Yeah, so I think it was a Dice podcast that was doing it. But yeah, it was... yeah, that was well worth a listen. He just spends the whole, like an hour and a half or something, going through the whole story of how they got everybody out and what have you. So yeah, it was as well worth a listen, just for general interest. But yeah, so and I will just say as well that on that same topic, actually, Alex did a talk at a recent DevGam conference they held in Vilnius, Lithuania, where he did a bit of a post-mortem on, which again, it's good to see the transparency of reflecting on things that didn't perhaps go quite as well as other things. He did a post-mortem on the sequel to the first Hello Neighbor game, which is Hello Neighbor 2. And the game didn't do as well as they had hoped, and it didn't quite live up to the hype. And he sort of goes into, he explains quite a lot of this, and I think you could put quite a bit of this down to these factors. Well, basically, just to lay it out a little bit as a brief overview, they released an initial trailer which had an awful lot of hype around it. A lot of the fans were really excited about it, and it was it sort of mentioned some cons or hinted at some concepts that would have been quite challenging to end up developing. And when they then had a hit by the pandemic and hit by war in Ukraine and everything like that, they had to kind of make a choice about, do we get a slightly more basic and less computationally challenging game out there, which will be technically perfect, so they can make sure that there's no bugs or anything like that and get it out released on schedule? Or do we go for the more ambitious title? We might only end up being able to get it out on the more powerful consoles initially, and might have to do some sort of scaled down version for the other ones, and they might not release simultaneously. And a key thing to note here is that quite a lot of the player base for the Hello Neighbor games are not on PCs. They have a lot more overall on other platforms, like the various consoles, Xbox, PlayStation, Wii, and they also have some the games ported to mobile forms as well on iOS. So they would have, if they'd gone for a more computationally advanced game with much more sort of powerful AI that was going to be following you around the town, I think was one of the concepts, it would have been difficult to do that and get that running on some of the other less powerful platforms, like the Switch, Nintendo Switch, and some of the iOS operating systems and so on, so iOS devices. So they kind of had to make that choice of scaling back the game a little bit, just because of the limitations they had, not only with all the events going around them and the stresses, putting some that kind of the kind of pressures that was going to put on the team to try and get such an advanced game out under the pandemic conditions and everything else. So they ended up putting out a game that wasn't quite as advertised, and as you can imagine, it wasn't quite as well received by their fans. It didn't do quite as well as expected. But yeah, that just gives you an idea of, even though they were getting the games out on time, there was still an impact from the pandemic, the conflict, and so on. So yeah, it didn't quite leave the studio unscathed. So yeah, maybe... Yeah, I think...
Just to circle back really quick. That interview was put out by the AIAS Game Makers Notebook, for anyone who wants to go find that.
That's great. Thanks for that, Spencer. Yeah. So maybe we should sort of address the elephant in the room at this point, which is the substantial fall in the share price we've seen over the last year, to the point where the stock now trades at about 5%, I think, 4 or 5. Well, currently about 5, but it's gone down as low as sort of 4% of the peak valuation they've had since the IPO. So Can you maybe sort of give us an idea of some of the factors that have caused this fall and help us to understand why the company isn't about to go bankrupt?
Okay, so there's two questions, and I'll split the first part into two questions itself. So I'll answer that in three parts. The first is going to be the fact that the fall in the share price has kind of come in two parts. There's been this kind of downward trickle, and there's been this big collapse with the pre-AGM announcement. Starting with the pre-AGM announcement, kind of simply put, it's definitely issues, but I think if your time frame is more than 18 months a year, that it's going to end up just being noise. I mean, again, there was the CFO leaving, there was the write down. But again, I think a year from now, that becomes noise. Next is the reason for that slow trickle down. And this kind of goes back to why the company IPO'd and why they're a Seattle US-based company listed in the UK. So the company IPO'd so its employees can buy in very easily. And a lot of those employees were US-based, but they chose to list in London because the management team at the time thought that's where the best comp set was. And so what ended up happening is you had a US base of investors who can't really buy. It's complicated, which I'll get into in a second. And then a UK potential shareholder base that didn't really have any interest. It's kind of become orphaned. And so even without that immediately will to sell, there was really no buyers. So then it becomes the what's so challenging about buying in the US? To say it's a process is kind of an understatement. So you can only buy through interactive brokers. Besides the standard kind of issues that come with interactive brokers, with the user interface not being good, you need to convert currency, of relatively simple things. The spreads are very large because there's not liquidity. They don't offer access to the main trading shares on the AIM London exchange. They only offer access in Frankfurt, Germany. And the spreads are very large. And interactive brokers caps the bids you can place. They will not let you place market orders. Market orders are not allowed. And they will cap the bids. So the only way you can actually buy is you kind of have to go on the Borsa Frankfurt website, figure out what the bid is, figure out what the ask is, match up your bid to that ask, and then after Interactive Brokers inevitably caps your bid, go call Interactive Brokers and convince them to remove that cap. For example, the day of the AGM announcement, pre-AGM announcement, where the stock sold off, I remember I sent a picture to one of my friends, a screenshot of what the bid-ask spread looked like. So at the ask, there was about 10,000 shares being sold. At the bid, I knew where Interactive Brokers capped it, and I knew how to look. I obviously know how to do this whole process. I've done it a few times now. And there, at one point, with only a 10,000 share ask, only a few percentage points above the Interactive Broker cap, at the Interactive Broker cap, there was over 600,000 shares asking to be bought. It's nuts. So there was a 10,000 ask, 600,000 people trying to buy at that ask or shares, and people couldn't figure out. You had to actually call up and convince them to get rid of this cap for you. And then so that creates an issue in itself, especially if you're a game developer and don't are not a big finance guy and don't know the ins and outs of this stuff. And then even if you are a finance guy and understand this type of stuff, like I've had people come and ask me how to do it, and I explain the process and they go, eh, it's too hard. That's too complicated. And so that isolates a good amount of the shareholders to begin with, or ability of, to attract shareholders, right? People who can actually go in and buy. And B, like at any given time, you could just go and check. And most days, wherever Interactive Brokers caps that bid, there's a massive buildup that's way higher than the amount of the ask. But people haven't gotten to that last step of you have to go match it up and then call. So it, that part is largely market mechanics as to why it is where it is. That, and then again, there was that big sell-off after the AGM, but it's an orphan, it's a true orphan stock that's being hit by market mechanics. And to the bankruptcy, another one, it's a pretty simple, no, they're not, I don't think they're going to go bankrupt. They have, there's no debt on the balance sheet. Even after the right, if you look at or the guide down, even after the guide down, they still expect to have $10 million in cash at the lower end, which is more than what they need to run the company. And like you said, 80% of the cash comes from the back, or yeah, 80% of revenue, I should say, comes from the backlog, which besides basically it just falls right to the bottom line. It's sunk costs already, gets amortized across however many people are spending money. And that's, again, just straight cash to the bottom line. Is they could just kind of turn off the growth engine and stop investing if they really need to and just monetize that back catalog for a little bit to get their feet under them. So, no, there is no bankruptcy risk. Because, again, especially with no debt, that definitely helps.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly don't have any issues with liquidity. Like you say, they've got the cash and they also have a completely untouched $35 million line of credit if they need it, but they don't expect to go anywhere near it. Maybe we should just, it's very interesting to hear the full story of how you mentioned before your struggles, but I hadn't heard the full blow by blow of how you actually have to buy the shares. Yeah, it's just crazy when I compare it to the ease of buying them in the UK. It's just can all be done online just through my broker really easy. There still is a volume thing. Like if I tried to move like a larger volume, probably like above like 5K or something, then that's something that would probably have to be done over a couple of days or a couple of goes, to just because my broker doesn't really keep that many sort of shares around and so on for liquidity and stuff. So it's kind of just to touch on, so a couple of things. One would be what sort of was the negative news really was there was the mention about the Versus Evil and Red Cerberus acquisition not performing as well as they'd hoped, which was one negative they released in that pre-AGM sort of trading update. The other thing was that basically it sounds like Microsoft, which they didn't mention, I don't think they mentioned Microsoft, but they said some of their platform partners, and we know that Xbox Game Pass is basically the biggest one, which had been quite a big source of revenue growth just for the last couple of years. They've sort of been building up and they've been putting some of their back catalog and also some of their newer releases onto here, which is kind of like the Xbox Game Pass can be thought of a little bit like Netflix for games or something. So you have like it's a subscription service where players come along, pay a subscription fee, and they get access to this whole catalog. And so Microsoft was basically, I guess, losing quite a bit of money because they were just paying upfront fees to try and build the user base. So I don't think, it sounds like Xbox Game Pass wasn't really profitable at this point. And so with Microsoft having to lay off loads of staff now and cutting back on loads of areas, they're one of the areas they're cutting back in is investment in the gaming segment, which is kind of ironic when you think about the Activision Blizzard deal, how much money they're spending there. Maybe it's the expenses they're making there that's have to make them cut back a bit on their Xbox Game Pass stuff. But yeah, they've cut back there, and it basically means that I think it was something like 30% of revenue of Tinybud's revenue last year. So it's a pretty sizable chunk, and we don't know whether it's all, not saying it's all going to go, but it's a fairly big chunk to lose if those fall down. And it's very much possible for the company to do just fine. They didn't have it as a, you know, until just a couple of years ago anyway. But yeah, it's something that in this period where they've now substantially invested in software development, but because there is this kind of delay with the proceeds from the IPO and what have you, which is another reason for doing the IPO, is to get some injection of something like $46-47 million of cash, which they could just immediately plow in to expanding their portfolio or their development pipeline. And so they've now got something like 30 games in development, including sort of DLCs and so on of existing titles. I think at least 20 brand new games in their development pipeline. And the thing is that games have there is a lag effect between initially making an investment and starting the project, and it taking sort of 2 to 5 years depending on the scale of the game. And they're moving more towards the doing larger titles that have sort of budgets of sort of between one and, historically they would do games that maybe their sweet spot was sort of $500,000 per title. They've now moved to doing some sort of bigger titles, like some of the Hello Neighbor games being bigger, or some other examples being some of the upcoming ones like Sand, for instance, it's coming out, I Am Future, I believe, as well. Ferocious, another one. So a few different titles that are Critico, yeah, a few other ones that are much bigger, sort of more ambitious titles. And these require more funding. They also often usually will take on the more towards the 5 year, the sort of maybe 3 to 5 year sort of range to develop. And but the returns can obviously be bigger because on a percentage basis, maybe similar, but then on an absolute basis, you're getting a bigger overall sort of absolute return rich one. But yeah, so increasing the scale here, but because of this lag effect, there was going to be a few years, and having these platform revenues coming in, so effectively allow them to get a little bit, squeeze a bit of extra money out of their back catalog, meant that, and yeah, and just as extra sort of monetization and getting a bit of, also gives them some upfront payments when they're developing games, helping to de-risk them a bit and so on. If that's now going a little bit, it means that there's going to be where previously they'd expected their cash balance to stay pretty much flat over the next year or so, as they were still waiting for some of these bigger titles to come out and to this pipeline to progress and come out, this big jump in spending to suddenly flow through to revenues and profits. While they were waiting for that period to happen, they were expecting the sort of existing platform revenues and the royalties from the back catalog and sort of the other games that are still coming out to carry it through and keep and maintain enough incoming cash to cover the ongoing development expenses. They're now expecting there to be a bit of a shortfall over the next year or so, which is why they're expecting the cash balance to come down a little bit. But yeah, as we said, lots of liquidity there to cover any shortfall. But yeah, that's why effectively we're going to expect to see a little dip in the next year or so while we wait for the actual big increased pipeline to start to flow through to revenues.
So I would touch on three things, right? Is on the bankruptcy point again, right? Even though the revenues in the back catalog will come down, if they need to turn off investment, if they get into that desperate of a scenario, which I don't foresee happening and I don't think you foresee happening, right? Again, they have ample cash. They have the credit line. But they should be good there. But worst case, they're not going to be generating nothing on that back catalog. And every dollar they generate is incremental right to the bottom line. So that's first worth, again, reemphasizing. So Microsoft is prioritizing AAA games. That's why they're making the decisions they're making at the moment. But I think kind of you want to backtrack to what I was saying before about gaming companies kind of being platforms and the consoles being a really good, maybe an even better example of a platform. where if you look at the history of consoles and look at something like a company like Nintendo, that every time these things happen, they tend to reverse, because Nintendo, for again, this is really going back in gaming history here. But if you want to look at Nintendo, Nintendo is at one point, I mean, they had 80-90% console market share, and they kind of shot themselves in the foot by saying, we're going to focus on our games, we're going to focus on the highest quality titles and isolating developers. And eventually, I mean, they still do that to an extent, but you kind of have to walk it back, because the content is king here, and the content comes from the developer community, and you can only spend so much time where you're saying we're going to prioritize AAA games and not have this new content until somebody new comes in and creates something on a different platform and won't come to your platform now. And consumers are willing to switch very quickly. If Microsoft starts to isolate the developer community and people only start making games for PlayStation or Switch, or with, right, the new ones coming out soon, or PC, consumers are very quick to switch. So, I mean, you throw in the and back catalog, the incremental all falls back or down to the bottom line. And that history shows that these problems always tend to be temporary. Otherwise, the gaming consoles end up hurting themselves more than they do the developers. In the end, this will probably work itself out.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Yeah. And something else perhaps to mention, just as you touched on with the difficulties international investors currently have of accessing the shares, is there are other companies out there, small game developers, for instance, like Team 17 is an example, listed on the AIM market at London Stock Exchange, which are quite relatively liquid and more accessible to US investors and beyond, through platforms like Interactive Brokers. And management of Tiny Build is now aware of this and the difficulties that international investors are having. So if they can open some lines of communication, perhaps with Interactive Brokers or similar platforms, there is hopefully a potential catalyst there, if we can sort of unlock some of these international markets, certainly remove some of the friction there.
Yeah, look, I know for a fact, because a lot of people reach out to me, that there is a decent amount of interest at the very least in people buying in the United States who cannot or will not take the extra effort to go and do it. And if they had easy access to just buy the shares on the AIM list, even the AIM listed shares, which are not exactly available everywhere, but still much, much easier than what I have to go through now and what shareholders or potential shareholders have to go through now, that having that access, that there is undoubtedly interest. Again, it's just hopefully unlocking that access.
Yeah. And, yeah, perhaps just a final thing to mention on like what really caused the massive drop on the 29th was there was a fund based up in Edinburgh, I believe, that had a 5% position in the company, which is equated to about 10 million shares. And they basically, they weren't the only one, because I think something like 50 million shares were traded on that day. But they certainly triggered a massive cascade by trying to sell into a very illiquid market, as we've discussed. So trying to offload, and bearing in mind as well, the insider ownership basically means that probably about half of the 200 million shares are effectively off market, because they're owned by insiders that aren't going to sell them, like Alex, for instance. And so you've only got that 10 million shares. It's probably 10% of the share capital of an illiquid company being liquidated on the open market, not even like a behind closed doors transaction or anything, which would have been the smart way to do it. They just try and sell them. They call the liquidity, but it's a bit of a stupid move, and doesn't sound like a particularly great management of their investors' capital, you know, in terms of from a fund management point of view. So slightly questionable behavior there, but yeah, that basically absolutely tanked the shares and took them below what could even be conceivably rational. I mean, I think when we both started writing about the stock, it was around about 5 times higher than where it is now, maybe a little less now, but certainly it's around about 50 pence a share or something, wasn't it? Yeah. And so at that point, the shares were still trading at pretty much a single digit PE, just below 10. And we thought they were undervalued then and had an awful lot of upside. And now we're looking at something where it's like a fifth of that value. So
I mean, that day it sold off, it was deeply, deeply into negative enterprise value territory.
Yeah.
I was like looking at this like, and that was even if you took the low end of the cash balance of what it would have been, it was still deeply into negative enterprise value. I'm like, you're basically buying a cash pile at
this point. Just a complete net, which is the downside of that point, it's pretty much zero. But as long as they don't just burn that cash away. But but given the protections they have in terms of the insiders being, as I would say, rational actors and good custodians of capital thus far, and having large inside ownerships themselves to defend against any destructive actions, and to keep us well aligned with external shareholders, I think we're about as protected against that kind of behavior as we can be. Maybe we've kind of touched on, alluded to a little bit there, but maybe just could you give us a little bit of an idea of what you would say is the investment thesis here and sort of what you see as the upside? Maybe what you saw as the upside back when you did your write-up, and then what do you see as the upside today, given how ridiculous I won't do a leading question, but how much cheaper it is today than it was then?
So I'll kind of flip that. I'll do the today part and then I'll go back into the initial part, because the initial stuff is what I touched on before, right? Kind of what they've done right and what we've touched on with Alex and all that stuff. But I mean, you're kind of looking at, a net, you're buying it below enterprise. I mean, even now, barely above net cash. And that's just cash. That's not any other assets. You're basically buying barely above net cash. And you throw in a robust pipeline on the way, strong IP with the Hello Neighbor franchise, and an excellent owner-operator. And before really getting into anything else, it's a pretty good setup. And then it's all that stuff we kind of touched on before, where, they do just about everything right. They do have some great IP. And I don't think it's unreasonable by any means they can get back to last year's cash flow numbers. And if they get back to last year's free cash flow, that's after adjusting out a couple things, take out stock-based comp or add back in stock-based comp, taking out the Ukraine expenses, and then use that to get to a normalized free cash flow. And before even putting a multiple on that, that's 3.5 times the current stock price. And you just kind of look at that and say, with all the things they have going for it, that's pretty reasonable. They can get back to that by 2025, put no multiple on that. You're looking at year and a half, 2 years of a 3.5x, and that's not a bad return. And I think most importantly, is that leaves very little downside, as you have an immense margin of safety there. And I like a bet where you have an immense margin of safety and that optionality of one of those games is a big hit. The Microsoft situation changes a little bit. A lot of things can go right when you have an aligned management team and you're buying at a great valuation in a business with, when done right, as they tend to do, have great economics, which you could see in the last few years, actually.
So if you had to put a figure on where you think sort of like the terminal value for the company would be, how big do you think it could get reasonably? Where would you think you'd put that figure?
I'm going to cop out here and go with it's impossible to say. I mean, look, you don't know how a lot of things are going to develop. I mean, you don't know how, right? Who would have said 15 years ago? I mean, this isn't the style of game necessarily they choose, but who would have seen the proliferation of mobile and how big that made gaming a few years ago? You can argue gaming is the best use case of the metaverse, where in metaverse, if you look at, go study up on Epic Games a little bit and learn, I forget the CEO, it's Tim, I forget his last name, but learn his vision of the metaverse, where you're connecting their Unreal Engine and it connects to Roblox, which connects to every other video game. And it's this immersive system where maybe it's not goggles on, but it's this interactive world where all these games interact. And it's like your that Second Life notion, where, because gaming is this unique experience where you have that social interaction, you have this unique content that lets you get away. And there's also kind of this competitive aspect that you don't get when you're looking at something like television or movies, which gives it this unique added layer. And also in that competitiveness, collaboration, which you don't quite get with TVs and movies. And you throw all that in, and the gaming market's limit as a whole is only kind of limited by how many people start to realize that maybe it's not just a kid's toy, which I think is becoming more and more where it's mass adopted, where, like, I have friends, I mean, mine personally don't, but I have friends whose parents still play and things along those lines, where now it's becomes less taboo in certain circles to be playing video games. And then it's the proliferation of technology and what type of new technology gets introduced. And all of a sudden you can play on your watch and you can play in your car and all these different, not while driving. and there's all these different places where you can touch and connect with people. And this is maybe the most interactive, the most immersive way to do it, where you get all the benefits of all that other content creation and getting away, then added benefits of collaboration and competitiveness that you don't get in other places, again, like TV and movies. So the market, as Jeff Bezos like to say with AWS, it's kind of market sized unconstrained. And so from there, it's how well does the management team execute in creating that great IP and great content? And in a content driven business, an IP driven business, you never quite know where that's going to go. So you have to trust your capital allocator. You have to trust that they're going to keep producing great IP. But from there, it's kind of what's the limit of technology and how many people adopt this. And I think if you believe in the metaverse, I don't think it's necessarily, again, goggles on. I think it's this idea that you're in a different world and it's a way to get away. And I think video games are the best way to do it. And I think there are people at the top of the industry, again, like what I think, go and study Epic Games and what they want to do and the Unreal Engine and the idea of connecting these different platforms and using them as platforms rather than games and having that as your second life, that creates market size unconstrained. And not to use it as a cop-out of saying we're going to the moon and all that stuff, but to say that there's tons of potential of where this can go. And as long as they execute right, which is of course always the case, but I think the potential is beyond immense. But more importantly is, given the valuation that you're buying at, given that there is already some high quality IP, given there is a pipeline coming on, given there is some relationship, though maybe not as good, with the bigger platforms like Microsoft, and you have a high level owner operator who's touched every part of the industry and is heavily invested personally in this, I think it's a really good bet to play that proliferation of gaming and metaverse technology, all that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I mean, when I originally wrote up the company, I did a bit of a, in a hyperbolic statement in my tweet, was something like, if I had to pick a company that was going to 5 or 10x in the next 5 years or something like that, I would say it would have to be Tiny Build or something like that. And the way I kind of arrived, and that was, remember, when it was around about 50 pence a share. And the way I kind of arrived at that was that I kind of envisioned, I looked at a few competitors. Like, in my mind, I'd previously looked at, and even early on in my investment days and put a little bit of investment in some of the other game publishers like Paradox Interactive, which now trades way too expensively for me to think about. I think it's something like 60 times earnings or something. But that companies like that, which, I mean, things like Paradox Interactive, for instance, is very much just pretty much solely within the PC gaming niche. So they're not even out, they're not even broadened really out onto to platforms much compared to Tiny Build, which is very much a multi-platform, fairly platform agnostic developer and publisher. But yeah, when I look to companies like that and I kind of look, think about it and I think looked at their IP and what have you, I just, and they're sort of in the low to mid companies of that sort of size, or sort of the low to mid billions of dollars kind of range, low to mid single digits or billions of dollars. And I just looked at them and went, I don't really see, as long as Tiny Build continues to operate and what have you, and they have some, obviously they do things right with the games they're picking out and so on, I really saw it as a pretty likely outcome that they would become something like, at least a, I didn't really see any obstacle to prevent them becoming like a one to at least a 1 to 2 billion kind of dollar market cap company at least. And just looking at that, and that's being pretty conservative, and they don't have to have crazy hits to achieve that either, because that's just with their model of, you know, we're not relying on them to sort of hit it and absolutely like knocking the ball out of the park kind of hits to drive them there. Obviously that kind of thing accelerates the process, but just over time, if they continue their model of telling games, and I mean, all it takes is they've had a really good number of games that have sold sort of over 1 million copies individually. I listed a few sort of earlier, but they continue to keep putting them out. Like last year we had Potion Craft come out, which sold over 1 million copies, quite a unique sort of indie game. And it, all it takes is just a continuous, you know, a few of those each year. And as the company expands and their pipeline expands, the chances of having those and whatever increases. And their sort of target for all of their games is to have at least a 2x of the initial investment. So if they just keep going on that sort of model and they average that sort of conservative, that 2x, they have some games that outperform, some that underperform, they average at least the 2x. Eventually, that is an incredible overall return, and the growth, you know, revenue overall and earnings and overall would be great. The company would be highly profitable, and it could easily, just on that basis, it'd take a little bit longer, but it wouldn't need any heroics to get to the sort of, I believe, to that sort of 1 or 2 billion dollar mark over time. And if you took that from the share price that, as I mentioned, of sort of 50 pence, that would be a sort of a 10x from there, just to get to the sort of the 1 to 2 sort of billion mark. And then if you take the current share price now, well, let's just say it's about 13 pence now, I think, but let's just make it easy and say it's 10 pence. You can basically multiply that by another 5. So you can have anywhere from, you know, it's getting well into the double digits anyway. You could be getting anywhere up to 50, and then there's still upside beyond there. So it's really even without, I mean, it really wouldn't require that much more to, it's even somewhere in the distance, you can see 100 bagger. it's somewhere ethereal in the distance, but I can see the shape of it. I can see it has the potential to do it. It might not. Being conservative, I think there's a really good chance, especially from this price, that 5 or 10x is, if the company does, you know, survives and continues, 5 or 10x is pretty likely. And then there's just lots of upside from there.
Look, I don't see why not. I mean, again, if you want to go back and like touch on a few of the things I went into in the what they do right? Take the portfolio approach where they first have a bunch of these, and we'll, again, right, to marry in right away two concepts. Portfolio approach and franchise, where first you have a portfolio of franchises, and then from there, ubiquitous distribution where they're all going across every platform, and then leveraging all of that into other forms of media, like, again, the comic books and the things like that. And you just start to see where all these different growth vectors, avenues for reinvestment, and there's a lot of potential. It's a matter of execution, which is always the case, but the opportunity is immense.
Absolutely. So maybe it would be we definitely should now, I think, having hyped it up a bit, we should probably do a bit of a post-mortem and assume if this doesn't work out, if this investment were to go horribly wrong, and it ends up just maybe stagnating, never really recovering from where it is now, or ends up going bankrupt, what do you think will have happened? What are the risks what are the things that could have transpired to allow those negative outcomes to take place?
I think there's really one negative, and I don't think it'll happen because you got to have a little bit of trust here, a little bit of faith, but it's capital allocation. This is a capital allocation story, that it's a matter of the management team and Alex seeing a large slate of opportunities and saying which ones are the right ones to chase and put our dollars into. And if they put them into the right ones and they do this smartly, as they've mostly been proven right to do so far, it'll work out well. If they have a lot of misses, and there's a couple of those as well, it'll not work out well. And that's really what it comes down to, is a poor capital allocation or good capital allocation is what's going to make or break this company at the end. And it's, do you trust management's ability to be able to identify and develop these games? Management teams are.
Yeah. And I guess as well, that extension of that would be acquisitions as well. If they don't learn the lessons from what they've from Versus Evil and what have you, if they were to continue trying to a similar sort of strategy, I don't think it's really possible right now with the depressed share price, but let's say things do recover and they start doing some more of that kind of stuff in the future, and aren't particularly, they don't learn the lessons and they make some mistakes with fairly big acquisitions, that could be something that would be an impact as well.
It's all in this business and how they have it set up. It's capital allocation, acquisitions, what projects to fund, the acquihires. I mean, it all plays in of how they allocate capital and do they do it well.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much an all encapsulating summary of all the different things I potentially could have thought of as well. Yeah, they all stem down to that, to capital allocation really fundamentally, and if they're not going to be stupid with it. But given everything that you could possibly have to align management with shareholders, is there, the CEO is the largest shareholder, so any mistakes he makes or the company makes are acutely felt by him. So if things do go downhill, if capital allocation decisions aren't made correctly, if they release games before they're ready and they end up being flops or whatever, all this kind of stuff all comes back and hits him where it hurts as much as or more than the other external shareholders. So yeah, it's you're about as protected as you can be. Any company can make bad capital allocation decisions, but you've got as much protection as you can have, really, I think.
Yeah, look, like I said, I mean, you got to have a little bit of faith. Right, it's kind of, that's an intangible thing to count on, very intangible. But you have a guy who's touched every part of the industry, and he's this amazing combination of, he's a nose to the ground hustler, and he's a great thinker, and he's good with people as well. And then you throw in, he owns almost 40% of the shares, and I think within the next year or so, this is a whole nother subject of, he'll eventually own more shares. And I think that's a good horse to put your money with.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, they
shot down the proposal. I think, yeah. Hopefully next year.
Yeah, you were. I think you're referencing at the AGM there was a proposal table to allow Alex to purchase more shares, which would have been potentially a good catalyst for closing the crazy discount that is available at the moment. But he wasn't able to participate in that, so it was down to the remaining sort of roughly 60%, and just shy of they didn't quite get enough. It was just below the majority required. So yeah, that didn't pass, unfortunately. I think that would have been a good thing for shareholders overall. I do wonder why exactly. And I think perhaps some vested interests in funds or whatever kind of stuff got a little bit in a way there. But anyway, it's I think perhaps as well, I do see a potential eventuality where once they get through this, they've obviously got more important uses for cash right now for getting the business through this period while they've got these big development commitments to continue developing the pipeline. And until they start to see the revenue coming in from some of those, the expanded development, they need to hold on to their cash at the moment. But if in like 18 months, 2 years beyond when these releases start coming out and the underlying revenues and operating income, what have you, the company starts to recover, if the share price hasn't recovered, I think they would, you know, I would be surprised if they weren't considering things like share buybacks to help just bring back some rationality. But I personally don't think it will be necessary, because I think as quickly as the market turned against it, as soon as things return to growth and it's obvious that the company's not going, you know, not going out of business, which I believe is obvious now, but obviously not to the market overall. As soon as everything gets back on track with things and they get past these near-term headwinds, I imagine things especially with the illiquidity of the shares, things will swing the other way quite quickly. So I doubt that will be necessary, but that's something to keep an eye on and so on in the coming years. I think we'll both be keeping a close eye on that. And when it gets to that point, if things are not turning round and what have you, that maybe we'll be making suggestions along those lines. But I think we've touched on an awful lot there. Pretty much anything. Can you think of anything else that we maybe should touch on with it?
Nothing off the top of my head. I think we covered it well.
Yeah. So thanks again for coming on, Spence. I think this has been great.
For having me.
Maybe you could just give people an idea of where they can find you, tell people about your Substack, any other resources, your Twitter, anything else you want to mention.
Sure. Cool. Thank you. So the Substack is probably a good start. I put out a newsletter once a week called the Thursday Think Tank. The Substack is called Breely Capital, which is BREELEY. Capital is capital. So you could subscribe there. Everything's completely free, no paywall, access to the whole archive, every post every week. That's that. And then Twitter is all one word, Breely Capital again, BREELEY. And then LinkedIn, which I don't use too much, but a decent amount. I have my personal as well as a Breely account.
Excellent. Yeah. So everyone be sure to go have a look at all those resources. And of course, all the other things we mentioned, the various podcasts, the Ukraine one was particularly good one. Maybe Alex's talk, I recommend giving all them a look. But yeah.
And thanks. Yours. What he did with you was very good.
Yeah, I was good to really good to have that talk with Alex, and it's a pretty digestible and 35 minutes, so yeah, it's pretty easy for people to fit in. Yeah, so thanks everybody for listening. Thanks Spencer for coming on. We'll have more episodes in this series, but getting on more guests. So this is going to be a new series called, as I mentioned, Firm Discussions. So see everybody in the next one. Thanks again, Spencer.
Thank you for having me.